Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with National Library of Medicine Director, Dr. Donald Lindbergh. Also joining us in our conversation is Marion Ball. Dr. Lindbergh, what role does the National Library of Medicine play in communicating with physicians and researchers about medical findings? Does the library push this information to practitioners, or is the focus more on providing information that is accessible to those who are searching for it?
Well, it's primarily the second, because we reflect the scientific articles that are published in peer-reviewed journals, and that would amount to, say, 500,000 a year, roughly. And if you add it up, I mean, there's way over 15 million in the whole file, so that's a lot to push. What we're really suggesting is that rather than trying to read everything that's available, clearly impossible task, that a doctor or a patient, but a doctor particularly, is better off to ask us to describe the clinical circumstances, let's say symptoms or maybe a diagnosis or maybe a drug, than to ask our system to pop up the most recent publications on that topic. So that's how it's generally used. And we've done studies in the past years to can give you the details of it, of course, but we've done studies in which we essentially look, with permission, look over the doctor's shoulder and how he or she uses it, and then go into more detail about circumstances in which it was surprisingly helpful or occasionally not helpful. So we know that many of the circumstances in which a doctor does that kind of a search are ones in which it isn't a mystery. In other words, the idea that you put in the symptoms, the computer makes the diagnosis, is a kind of an old-fashioned comic book idea. Occasionally you wanted to do that, but that's not the major circumstance. In fact, one of the very commonest circumstances is the doctor who has a patient, who has a diagnosis, and who also has a therapy. But the doctors often say, well, gee, you know, I remember that therapy when I was a resident 15 years ago. I wonder if the same thing is the right thing to do now. So if you do that kind of a search, you'll come up with a recent paper. That's what you want. And if it says, yeah, the same thing you have in your mind is still the right thing to do, you say, great. Now, the benefit to the patient is tremendous because that's the quality control in medicine. It isn't a surprise. It's a happy circumstance, let me say. And then there are other more complicated uses, but that's a very common one.
Hmm. We spent a fair amount of time talking about the electronic databases.
Yeah.
But the National Library of Medicine also maintains a hard copy library in Bethesda. Do you have any unusual collections in this library?
Well, it's the biggest medical library in the world, so I think there are always surprises. I mean, the only thing close to it is the British Library. In the U.S., there are some major university libraries, of course, in the U.S. as well. The fact of the matter, truthfully, is that no medical library has everything, so we wouldn't make that claim. I think it's easily the biggest, but at the end of every year, every library ends up with questions users have asked that they can't answer. The only way that they can function at all close to that 100% is by the consortial approach. There's a National Network of Libraries of Medicine that NLM funds, and that we created in a way in 1965 under the authorization of the Heart Cancer Stroke Act that, as you'll remember, DeBakey did the study and presented it to LBJ, and then it became a national policy. But that gave us the authority to make that network. It turns out that medical people and library people have an impulse to share. So sharing is at the basis of that network. And it's a kind of a secret weapon in the U.S. I mean, it's really quite amazing that very few countries have this kind of an approach or a system. We get visitors every single week who are more or less asking, you Americans are doing something right. What is it? And one of the things is this network and the sharing.
Don, with regard to that, one of the special libraries, the History of Medicine Library, I think the audience would really like to know that such a treasure chest that you might like to address.
It is indeed. But, I mean, by virtue of being the biggest medical library in the world, we're also the biggest history of medicine collection in the world. Again, only rivaled, and I guess maybe partnered maybe by the British Library, although both the New York Academy of Medicine and Harvard have fine history of medicine collections as well. Again, there's a tendency to share all these things. We all know what the other person has. We once tried to make an arrangement where there would be at least two copies of everything and everyone would know where they were going to be. And we ran out of funding to do that. We still need to do it. And in fact, if you look at the international situation, many people would say you should do that and you should also have one out of a particular country but available to the world. So that is a job that remains to be done. But in any case, before I forget, I would like to invite your listeners to show up at the National Library of Medicine any day, although I guess working hours would be most convenient, and come in the front door and turn to the right and walk in the History of Medicine division. You'll find a lovely place. You'll find books published in the first 50 years of the book, between 1450 and 1500. Incunabula, they're called, cradle of the book. And you'll find lovely people to help as well, but they're very interesting things there. And if you, instead of turning to the right, go straight into the atrium, which used to be where the book catalogs were, but now it's a nice big open space that we use for exhibitions purposes. We've had a number of wonderful shows, but we just finished a show called Changing the Face of Medicine, which celebrates the achievements of women in medicine. And that's now circulating through the country. And we're now building a new one on essentially forensic medicine. But your listeners are cordially invited to show up anytime.
Don, you mentioned a little bit earlier the National Center for Biotechnology and also the Lister Hill Center. Could you address the mission of those two organizations within the National Library of Medicine?
Yeah, well, the second is the easiest. It was created by legislative authority in 1989, National Center for Biotechnology Information. And the authorizing legislation was introduced by Senator Pepper, Claude Pepper, who was at that time the oldest member of the Congress with some of the newest ideas. And you can see that creating the center to do data for human genome when it hadn't even started, it was quite farsighted. So they are very, very busy just simply handling the information, the knowledge, the structures, the data, the facts that are just growing so fast, and really, again, all over the world. The human genome was a distributed national experiment and quickly became a distributed international experiment. The very idea that it was a human genome was always kind of in quotes because at the least it involved a number of other important reference species, including yeast and coli and, you know, so forth. But now there are tens of thousands of species that provide the data for the human for the so-called genome projects. So the people there have been very, very wonderful in their achievements and very, very busy. But I should tell you that at the authorization was from the Congress. It didn't come with any money. It's just authorizing. And so we had to sweat the money out of our existing budget. But even worse than that, in those days, the toughest thing to get hold of was FTEs, was the permission to hire another person, another employee. And I remember the deputy director of NIH in those days, Ed Rahl, after a lot of consideration, called me and said, "Don, we figured out how to do it. We're going to give you 12 FTEs. And I remember he said, "And don't you give a darn one of them to an administrator." He wanted scientists. And so we started with 12. There's now around 300 people. And they keep getting requests every day to do things that are clearly important and valuable. And, you know, a lot of them are very difficult to say no to. So I don't know where that's going to end, but I do know I'm out of space.
Don, we've talked to some of the people at the VA and the Department of Defense and looking towards the what they call the medical passport or the personal health record. How far do you think that the civilian population is from this type of information, and what do you think are the major challenges to get there?
Well, I hope we're not very far, but as you know, both of us have spent a full 40-year career waiting for all this to happen. Probably it really is true now that we are not technically held back by the ability of computers or even token devices. I think we're held back by the lack of a absolute determination to do this. Now, you mentioned VA. VA has been really a very distinguished leader in the use of computers in medicine. They have very, very nice systems. And DOD has pitched in and done what they can, too, over a period of years. It's, of course, a huge organization, difficult to do even a simple thing quickly. But I participated with both of those organizations and admired their good works. At the moment, what you have is a limited number of excellent systems, let's say maximum 12, 6 to 12 in different parts of the country, with an inability to communicate between them. I mean, there is no national standard for this electronic health record. There is no interchange standard. And there's a lot of good activity to try to bring that into being. The current administration actually is surprisingly supportive and strongly committed to this, both at the level of the White House and also the Secretary of HHS. So this is it's a reason to rejoice from my point of view. I think we're closer to it now than we've ever been. And how long it'll really take is anyone's guess.
Well, Don, you've been involved in so many of the seminal documents, the one that's ending the document game, connecting the and transforming your healthcare through information technology. You played a major role in that. Do you think that the recommendations that have been made are actually being taken and are moving forward with the Braler offices and learning from all of the experiences that you've brought to the table?
Well, the simple answer is yes, I do. I think that, you're referring to a commission on computer systems interoperability that was made up of outstanding people and very, very competent and able and conscientious. But, you know, one of the things we figured out early in the game, there was very little argumentation amongst these knowledgeable folks. One of the things we figured out early in the game is that, and I believe this, that in the end, the people get what they want. I mean, this is the U.S. of A. And the fact that we don't have a electronic health record for everybody is because the people have not demanded that. You know, honest to God, that's the way it works. If each of us said to our doctor, look, I'm not going through this anymore. I want an electronic health record, and I hope you can get it for me, but if you can't, I'll find somebody else, you'd have it in a hurry. So a lot of the focus of that commission actually was to take testimony, if you will, throughout the country, listening to people, the real people, say, why would a person be interested in an electronic health record? And if you read that report, you'll find just a steady stream of individuals who tell not only heart-rending stories, but quite informative stories. I mean, a mother, for example, with a child born to her with a brain defect such that it requires implanting tubes, you know, to equalize the pressures. Well, okay, this is one thing, but since then, this particular individual, and in the report, you'll see the individuals agreed to be identified, but personally. But I remember this lady saying, "Well, I think that this child has been seen at the, I don't know, something like 14 institutions and 7 doctors, and only 2 of the 7 doctors are still alive and in practice. And amongst the institutions, I don't know who's bought whom, but basically, she, the mother, is the record keeper." The big paper bag is the record keeper. And some of those records are things like x-rays that, or pneumoencephalograms, that sort of thing, that are dangerous to repeat. I mean, to repeat it because somebody lost the old one, which will happen. I mean, and you know, if you don't have a mother like that, you will, in fact, get the repeat unnecessary test. So there were just scores of individuals that essentially said they're totally sick and tired of, as a patient or as a family member, having to pick up all of this nonsense and, you know, sincerely demanding that the medical profession or the hospitals or the doctors or the government or whoever wants to take it up fix it. So I would say to your listeners, they are the problem and they are the answer. The people will get what they really want, and it's about time the people just darn well demanded this electronic health record.
What does the future hold for the National Library of Medicine? We will ask Director Dr. Donald Lindberg to discuss this with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.